Is there a link between the Nazis and Islam? Welcome back to Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb, and our next guest believes the answer is yes, and he documents it in his 2010 book, The Nazi Connection to Islamic Terrorism, Adolf Hitler and Haj Amin al-Husseini. This program is being pre-recorded in late August to air on September 11, 2014, the 13th anniversary of 9/11. Chuck, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me aboard.
Now, you write in your book, the very opening of the book says this: I wrote this book in response to the Islamic terrorist attack of September 11, 2001. That's the opening sentence of your book. And my question is, how do the Nazis fit into 9/11?
Well, like all Americans, I was looking for some answer to the level of hatred that led to that unprecedented and unprovoked and dastardly attack, which killed almost 3,000 Americans on our soil. What is it that we did that led to this? And I discovered the whole business of international jihad and the idea of Islam dividing the world into two spheres, that Islam was an international conquering political entity that sought to subject the entire planet into a one-world order under the scimitar. But I also discovered that a great deal of the inspiration for modern jihadism, which is a part of Islam, but which was one that was somewhat dormant in the early part of the 20th century, emanated from the influence of Nazi Germany, which, of course, after the Nazis were defeated, that influence was picked up by the Soviet Union and international communism, where you see, for example, today, there is a tacit alliance between the international left and their unwitting camp followers and the radical Islamic movement. We saw a demonstration of that recently with the aggression from Gaza against the State of Israel, and how you had the Gaza radicals, but also international leftists, some of them well-meaning, coming out and casting their lot with Hamas.
And just by way of background, you're a journalist and talk show host, and you live in the Boston area, correct?
That is correct.
And you wrote this book, again, The Nazi Connection to Islamic Terrorism, Adolf Hitler and Haj Amin al-Husseini. Can you explain who Haj Amin al-Husseini is, and why is he important for us to know today in 2014?
Well, the story starts with this one character, Haj Amin al-Husseini, who was called by the Nazis the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, and his introduction of a poison into the Islamic world, his alliance with the Nazis, his becoming literally an Arab Nazi head of state during World War II, which he spent in Berlin, his close collaboration with Hitler, with Eichmann, with Himmler, with other Nazis, both in terms of the launching of the death camps, but also in terms of injecting Nazi ideology into the Middle East. Haj Amin al-Husseini was appointed as Grand Mufti of Jerusalem by the British
authorities. Can I ask you a quick question? What does that phrase mean, Grand Mufti of Jerusalem?
Well, he was the Mufti of Jerusalem, which is allegedly the religious Islamic leader of the British Mandate of Palestine.
Wow, okay.
The Nazis gave him the eponym Grand. They just added that to the title. But he was appointed by the British government, the British Mandate government, headed by Herbert Samuel, who himself was a very liberal British Jew, in 1920 as the Mufti of Jerusalem. This was after he had instigated an anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish pogrom in Jerusalem known as Bloody Passover, where 55 Jews were massacred, and that he fled the country. He came back. Samuel pardoned him, and not only did he pardon him, but he made him mufti over the objection of the local Arab population, which had wanted nothing to do with him. The reasons for that are murky, but the fact is that it set a pattern by which Western powers, both the United States and Great Britain, have often sided with radicals in the Middle East and at the expense of more moderate forces. But either way, he went on to become Mufti. He used his influence to continue with these pogroms against Jewish settlers. He had an implacable hatred for Jews. including one in 1929, which wiped out the Jewish community of Hebron, which had been an indigenous and ancient Jewish community. The British responded to that by making what we call, the media calls, the West Bank, completely stripped of all Jews. They removed Jews because they claimed for their own safety. In the 1930s, he launched a general revolt against the British. He initiated what's called the suicide bombers, not against the British and against the Jews, but against fellow Arabs who were, he felt were collaborating with the West. We saw this phenomenon repeated recently in Gaza when Hamas, during the height of the war, where they were launching missiles at Jewish population centers, was daily executing approximately 25 of their fellow Arabs, allegedly who were collaborating with Israel. Anyway, the British got wind of it. They kicked him out of Palestine. He then goes on to...
Okay, wait. Okay, since this is so important to understand the dates and everything, when did the British kick him out of Palestine, or even what decade are we talking about?
Well, they kicked him out in 1936.
Okay,
It's interesting to note that just before his exile, he met with Eichmann, who visited Palestine for one day on a trip to Egypt as a diplomatic mission. And this was confirmed by the Yad Vashem Jewish Holocaust Memorial in Jerusalem when I met with them.
Wow.
They agreed that this had occurred. At that point, he went on the Nazi payroll. He was outright collaborating with the Nazis on their program. He then ends up in Lebanon, then he goes on to Iraq, where in 1940 he initiates an anti-British coup against the pro-British government, placing in power a Nazi government, which was then subsequently was thrown out. From there, he goes on to Iran, where he cultivates, pro-Nazi government in Tehran, and then on through Italy up to Berlin at the height of the war, 1940 we're talking. And at that point, he met with Hitler in a very famous meeting, of which was on the cover of Nazi magazines. This was a couple of months before the so-called Final Solution and the meeting at Wannsee, where he encouraged Hitler to exterminate all of the Jews of Europe. Hitler at that time promised that once the Nazis conquered the Middle East, after they crossed through the Caucasus, he would make the Grand Mufti as the head of a Nazi Arab empire under Nazi alliance. He is funded throughout his period there by monies that had been looted from Jewish families who were sent off to the concentration camp, what was called the Sonderfund, monies that were funneled through Swiss bank accounts by Nazi Swiss banker Janoux. He funnels monies into the Middle East to set up pro-Nazi cells. He engages in broadcasts that were blood-curdlingly anti-Semitic and anti-American. He sends letters to Nazi puppet states urging them to send their Jews to the concentration camps. He visits the concentration camps, even telling Eichmann, who was tempted toward the end of the war, to sell or to ransom about 3,000 Jewish children to the West for needed monies. He put a nix on that. He said, no, send them to Auschwitz because little Jews will grow up to be big Jews. He then, at the end of the war, and one step ahead of a Nuremberg tribunal subpoena, Germany.
So at this point, so at the end of the war, this man you're talking about, Haj Amin al-Husseini, at one time in charge of Palestine,
right,
as the Muslim leader and so forth, he's living in Germany. He gets a subpoena after the war. He's got to go to the Nuremberg trials to be, there were only about 25 or whatever. I forgot the exact number of people, men that were tried at that, Goering being the most famous of them. And he manages to escape and pick it up from there.
Right. He escapes because the Yugoslavian government wanted him as a collaborator in the setting up of the Hanza units. Those were pro-Nazi Muslim units in Serbia and Bosnia that were massacring Serbs and Jews and Gypsies and others.
Wow.
He then gets through Paris, ends up making his way to Cairo, where he's given a hero's welcome. He sets up irregular brigades to attack Israel. One of his last acts in the Nazi government was to try to arrange for the bombing of Tel Aviv through gas bombs and the poisoning of wells in Tel Aviv, which he was not successful doing. While in Cairo, his nephew, Yasser Arafat, runs guns to irregular troops who are attacking Israel in 1947, 1948, during the War of Independence, when he's recognized as the head of the Palestinian state in exile. At that time, he calls for all Arabs to leave Palestine in advance of forming armies, which will then come back in and reconquer Palestine for him as head of state. He sets up the refugee camps in Jordan. He was directly implicated in the assassination of the Jordanian king Abdullah, who was about to sign a peace treaty with the new state of Israel.
That would be what, in 1948 or so?
Yeah, in 1948, 1949, when Abdullah was stabbed to death at the Al-Aqsa Mosque in the presence of his grandson, who would become King Hussein.
Wow.
He agitates in the Arab countries for continual war against Israel at a time when they wanted to make peace with Israel. His final act in public was his appearance at an all-Arab conference in Pakistan, where he called for the annihilation of all Jews living in the Arab and Islamic countries. And then he dies peacefully in his own bed in Beirut in 1975. His house was investigated, and in there they found blueprints for concentration camps that he was planning on building once the Nazis had liberated Jerusalem in the city of Nablus. So we're talking about a person who has to be viewed not only as one of the biggest anti-Semites in history, right alongside Hitler and Haman, but someone who radicalized the Middle East, not just against Israel, but against the United States and against the West.
It's amazing. Okay, this, most people, have never heard of Haj Amin al-Husseini, and that last name is spelled A-L and then dash Husseini, H-U-S-S-E-I-N-I. By the way, what does Hussein mean? Even our own president right now, Barack Hussein Obama, we remember Saddam Hussein. Obviously, pretty common name in some Arab circles.
Well, it's interesting that you bring that up. It is a name that is only given to Muslims, and it's a strictly Islamic name. He came from a wealthy landowning family in Palestine, who was in the employ of the Ottoman Empire for hundreds of years as tax collectors. And his radicalism, it should be noted, was not typical at the time in Arab circles. Many Arabs, including many prominent Arabs, such as King Faisal, wanted to welcome back the Jewish people to their ancient homeland. This was in accord with their understanding of the Quran. They wanted this to be done in such a way that the new state of Israel would help the Arab states become sovereign and would help them enter into the modern world with modern technologies and ideas of democracy. And obviously they demanded that the new state respect Islamic holy sites and the Muslim minority. And to that degree, Faisal, the king of Syria, signed an agreement in 1919 with Chaim Weizmann. It was part of the Paris Peace Conference that ended World War I, part of the Treaty of Versailles, that essentially recognized the State of Israel as his, with him acting as the chief plenipotentiary of the Arab world. He was a considerable figure at the time in the Arab world. He was thought of as a direct descendant of Muhammad. He was a devout Muslim.
You're talking about al-Husseini at this point?
No, we're talking about King Faisal.
Oh, okay. All right, go on.
And King Faisal was very Western-looking. He wanted the Arab countries and the Islamic countries to become sovereign and to become modern and to live peaceably alongside a very modest and small Jewish state, which would exist between the Jordan River and the sea. And that's exactly where Israel is today.
Mm-hmm.
He sent a letter to Felix Frankfurter, who at the time was the Harvard Law School dean and who was a Zionist, saying that he welcomed back the Jewish people to their ancient homeland, in accord with our Quran. We welcome them back with a hearty welcome. We look forward to working with them to help our own countries become modern and independent. I mean, it's such a forward-thinking document, and I publish it in my book.
Mm-hmm.
And I would argue it's a document that should be viewed as international law and custom. It was a ratification of the Balfour Declaration as part of the Paris Peace Conference, and that it was the view of many, if not most, Muslims and Arabs at that time, at the end of World War One.
Okay, so to get the kind of the overall perspective, this fellow that you wrote the book about, Haj Amin al-Husseini, essentially poisoned the Arab waters toward this hatred towards Jews, stoking some elements that are they are found there in the Quran and some of the statements of the Hadith of an anti-Jewish nature. You can also find some positive statements, but you know, let's face it, the ones, I mean, even to this day, Hamas and some of the Palestinians are even trying to cheat. They are teaching children, their children, to hate the Jews, to grow up to kill Jews, to be proud of killing Jews.
Quite clearly. I mean, he introduced this poisonous interpretation of the Quran into the Islamic world. I'm not suggesting it wasn't already there, but there was a window of opportunity right at the end of World War One for Islam to become more normalized and to join the civilized world, to start to become modern nations. That was the vision of Faisal. That was the vision of many other Islamic leaders and Islamic peoples. But Haj Amin al-Husseini, he completely poisoned the well. He was one of the establishers of the Muslim Brotherhood, which sought a radical Sharia rule of the world under a caliphate. That was Hamas, by the way, is an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood. He then introduces Nazism into the Middle East in the form of a sort of a hybridized Islamic Nazi ideology. And then after the war, he continues onward with alliances with the Soviet Union and with communism. We should note that Arafat and his cell, the PLO, which I get into in the book as well, was a complete creation of the Soviet Union. He was trained in Moscow in a communist college. They went into the Middle East for the purpose of destabilizing, these countries and bringing about a world socialist revolution through terror. And those are the tactics that are very much animating the radical Islamic movement today. In fact, Khomeini, the founder of the mullahs in Iran, his brother was a communist. He had communist connections while in Paris. There were communists in his movement, and it's a very left-wing movement, in fact, because the communists, as I mentioned, they picked up the cudgels from the Nazis after 1945 in terms of trying to influence the Arab and Islamic world away from the Western democracies, away from the United States. And their war against Israel is a war against the West. I think that should be obvious to anyone who is casually observing the scene.
Yeah, although, of course, our media sometimes will put it out like you've got Israel and Hamas as if there's a moral equivalency there, and you don't really see the full picture here, where the Hamas are using their own children as shields and so forth, and they become casualties in the war, and it's Israel that kills them. And then you see the statistics, so few Jews killed in Israel in the bombings versus so many of the Palestinians killed, and the Jews become the bad guys, in effect.
Well, they're complaining that there aren't enough Jews killed. I mean, it's an outrage, and it's gotten so obscene that they're claiming that the Israelis are deliberately killing innocent people, which, of course, undermines the moral authority of Judaism. Now, look, I understand the conflict in that I understand and I get the idea that the Palestinian Arabs want sovereignty in Israel. This is a struggle between two peoples for one tiny little piece of land. I would simply argue that the Jewish claim to Palestine is superior on many, many levels, religiously, politically, and across the board. The Arabs have 23 sovereign nations. Many of them are oil-rich and mineral-rich. And I would argue that they should look back at the Faisal Accord and recognize the very modest and very proper claims of the Jewish people to sovereignty in their own country, and look at the reality, which is that the state of Israel is a dynamic state today, a great society that could influence and aid the Arab and Islamic countries in terms of their own people throwing out these corrupt oligarchies who are basically oppressing their own people and enriching themselves in the process. I mean, this is why Israel is such a threat to Islamic countries in many ways. I also advocate, especially in light of the Hamas war, that the state of Israel should offer citizenship to people living in what the media calls the West Bank, but which in fact historically is called Judea and Samaria, and stop this nonsense, this charade about a two-state solution, an idea which, by the way, was cooked up in Hanoi in 1973 after the PLO met with the North Vietnamese and asked them, how is it that you guys are so popular and we're so hated? They gave them two strategies. They said, number one, stop talking about massacring the Jews and start talking about liberation. And number two, promote this idea of a two-state solution because you can take half of it now and then push the rest into the sea later. I would say stop the charade, offer citizenship to Palestinian Arabs on the West Bank. They should go through a process of a couple of years of education about Israel and about the Bible and about the purpose of the mission of the State of Israel, just like Israeli children go through. And then if they take a loyalty oath to the State of Israel, they should receive full citizenship and become Israelis.
All right, we're talking right now with Chuck Morse. He's the author of The Nazi Connection to Islamic Terrorism, Adolf Hitler and Haj Amin al-Husseini. Is there a website you want to promote, Chuck?
Well, they can get the book, of course, at the WorldNet Daily Books website, and they could go to my own Amazon and Amazon Kindle page just by putting my name in the server, that being Chuck Morse, Morse like Morse code.
Okay, and you're a journalist and a talk host, and you live in Boston, and you even ran against Barney Frank way back when for U.S. Congress. Good for you. I hope you, in some ways, helped him get off his game. But for those who may have just joined us, tie this in, without being repetitive, to 9/11.
Well, again, I mean, you have to take a look at the whole milieu that led to this sort of radicalization and hatred that would cause an Islamic movement to think that they need to subdue the entire planet. It is a communist idea. It's a Nazi idea, this idea of world hegemony, of world control. They have no business attacking the United States. We're not a Muslim country. They are also involved with both outright jihad, bloody jihad, and subversion, moving within, like what's happening, frankly, in Europe, where you have people who reach a point of the tipping point in terms of population, and then they start demanding Sharia adherence within their country. You know, it's a more of a subtle, sort of a peaceful hand of Sharia and of jihad. And that's what's going on here. This is a world-conquering movement. We in the West should not necessarily point a finger of blame at that when we've had our own two world-conquering movements in the 20th century, the two socialist experiments that are known as Nazism and communism. And basically, the ideas that they represent are the diametric opposite of the American idea, which is limited government under a constitution, where the people are sovereign, and where we grant government certain responsibilities under very strict sets of rules and of laws. So we need to contrast our civilization with theirs. And I actually think that George W. Bush did a pretty good job of that, in at least some of his public speeches right after 9/11. And we need to stick with that principle and understand the difference, understand the nature of the enemy, and understand what we're up against, because this is a world war.
Now, you show in the book how pictures, you have a picture of Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf book, which he wrote in 1925, and this is being sold in Palestine in the 21st century, among the Palestinian people.
One of your authors at WorldNet Daily Books, Jan Pasepa, who was the highest-ranking Eastern Bloc defector who was given asylum in the United States by President Jimmy Carter in 1978, he was part of a movement by which the KGB, headed up by Andropov at the time, published millions of copies of an Arab translation of Mein Kampf and of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion and flooded it into the Middle East.
Wow.
They were involved in fomenting violence throughout the Middle East at that time as a process of disinformation, not just in a war against the State of Israel, but against the West. In fact, Yevgeny Primakov, the foreign minister of the Soviet Union, held a meeting at an Arab refugee camp in Lebanon called the Badawi Camp in 1975, where he presented this case as I say it. the best way to defeat the West and to implement world socialism is through terror. Right after that meeting, and by the way, Arafat was on the payroll of the Soviet Union throughout this time, right after that meeting, several Arabs infiltrated across the border into Israel where they massacred 50 infants in a nursing home, in a nursery school in Ma'alot. So, you know, they mean business, and that's exactly what they're about. The idea of terror is a way of destabilizing Western society. It's been that way since the days of the French Revolution. It's a strategy that makes people, in witnessing a complete overthrow of the moral code,
yeah,
search for answers and look for a white knight to ride in and save them. And that white knight is a communist knight.
Would it be fair to say, then, that during the days of the Cold War, that one of the manifestations of that was that the Russians and the Soviets and so forth were using Middle East violence to foment against the West? I've never, you know, made that connection in my mind even. That's fascinating, and it's worth exploring.
Oh, absolutely. Again, I'd recommend Wilner Daly's book by Mahai, Disinformatia, and others, where, yes, they indeed fomented radicalism in the Middle East amongst Arab and Muslim countries as a way to instigate terror war against the West. And now, you know, obviously the Arabs involved in this are the ones to blame.
Yeah.
But they received financial support, training, tactical support, propaganda support by the international left, and I think that that's still apparent. Most people on the left, you get a nincompoop like Tom Hartman, he's a left-wing talk show host, who talks about, you know, the missiles coming in from Gaza as firecrackers, and Gaza as a prison camp. He's a well-meaning dupe. I don't think he's consciously participating. But nevertheless, the talking points that he's reading off come from an agenda that is seeking, at its core, to destabilize the West, to destabilize the United States through terror.
So here we are on the 13th anniversary of 9/11. Do you think America, by and large, has understood the key lessons of 9/11?
I think we've learned many of the lessons, but yet look at what's happening. We still have DEFCON 3 terror alert, and we're still afraid. We're still letting people cross the border without being properly identified, and we don't know if that's going to result in the development of radicalized cells, that they very well could be part of ISIS. We've heard threats from ISIS, and those threats are real. And we need to recognize the fact that we are in a war. We need to understand the nature of the enemy. We need to identify why our system is superior to theirs. And we need to, from time to time, meet them on the battlefield in the real sense, both in the real sense, also in the sense of ideas. You know, we need to understand who we are and what makes us exceptional, and to be not afraid to articulate that and compare it.
Yeah, American exceptionalism, of course, is almost viewed as racism or something today, which is just crazy. Well, what important thing do you want to say in the last minute or so that you haven't said so far?
I would just like to say that we need to remember what it is that makes us Americans. You know, the moral and ethical code of Sinai, the idea of subsidiarity and of limited government, the idea of, you know, of that rights come from the creator and not from the state.
Yes.
You know, private ownership, all of the things that have made us great. They're not accidents. They're things that we've embraced. They're universal themes that other nations can also embrace. But in order for us to inspire ourselves, we, the rest of the world, we have to inspire ourselves. And it's a time to take stock of those things.
All right. Well, Chuck, thank you so much for being with us. Again, we've been talking with Chuck Morse, M-O-R-S-E, about his book, The Nazi Connection to Islamic Terrorism, Adolf Hitler and Haj Amin al-Husseini. Amazing stuff. Thanks again, Chuck, and thanks for writing the book, too.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Bye-bye now.